So welcome to the first part of your class on memoir, Héritage Rupture. I'm going to look at some of the debates which have been going on over the last 20 years and today in Britain. Because as you know, when you have your dossier in front of you in the exam, you are now obliged to say, oh, I'm going to look at this from the point of view of how it links with L'idée du progrès or Mémoire, Héritage, Rupture. Well, that's very good. But of course, it's much better if you can then put a paragraph, at least a paragraph, on where the link is. For example, the document we are studying in this exam is a very typical debate and asks the same questions as this debate and this debate. Oh, yeah, you're gaining points here, yeah? So rather than just saying, oh, it's Mémoire, Héritage, Rupture, that's, you know, it's, you'd be able to say, this is parallel. Is it typical? Is it atypical? These are very different questions than those which were posed in this debate or this debate. Yeah. Now, this is only a couple of sentences. Of course, you can't go and talk for 3 pages about this other debate, but it shows that you know things. And really, although there are technical elements to the CAPES, every year when you read the rapport, they say, you know, we want people who have a good general knowledge of British history. So, Mémoire, Héritage, Rupture, let's look at it. These are the some of the themes I'll be looking at. First of all, the explosion of memory. Secondly, schools and museums. Thirdly, occupying public space. And fourthly, debates, apologies, and protests. Can you see right back there? Yeah, can you see? Yeah. Oh, you have better eyes than me. That's good. Okay. So first of all, the explosion of memory. So this is the reason why Mémoire, Héritage, Rupture has come up. Over the last 30 years, the importance of memory among historians and in the general public is much, much higher. We do much more commemoration, much more commemoration. Why? I don't know, but one reason certainly is that the general experience of people, of ordinary people, is more validated today. The 60 years ago, your history books in school are great men, great men, great men, great men. And today there is much more an attempt to say, you know, what was the lived experience of the past? Now, it may be that this is a continuation of the rise of a democratic spirit, that of course, that although there's lots of elitism left, there is not the rigid elitism, justified elitism of before. You see this in many areas. You know that today, poor people wear jeans and rich people wear jeans. This is new. 100 years ago, you really, especially in Britain, you had the rich person with the top hat and the middle class person with the bowler hat and the working class person with the flat cap. This was real. There was a real difference. Everything you wore, everything you eat made you different. Today in Britain, rich people eat curry. And poor people eat curry. I don't mean that we're all becoming the same. I mean that there is, especially from the point of view of consumption, there is a certain democratization. It used to be the case 50 years ago. Now, if you were upper middle class, you listened to classical music and you didn't listen to popular music. This is not the case today. If you want to go to a Bruce Springsteen concert, it will cost you €250, you know? So there has been a certain democratization of consumption, not of income, of course, but of consumption. And this is probably one of the reasons that lived experience has become more important. And when you see the government giving money for a museum or for a festival or something, we expect more and more this not just to be for a small elite. Schools and museums are obviously important places. Well, you're obliged to say that. You can't write in your CAPES, schools are not important, nobody cares, because it's the CAPES, you know. But in any case, schools are places which transmit memory in the history class, but also in the music class, in the French class literature. It's about transmitting culture, whatever that is, yeah? And so we're going to look a little bit at what happens in schools and museums. Museums are interesting. There are far more museums than there were 50 years ago. And in fact, they discover that every time you open a new museum, more people go to the museum. There's a demand which increases. There is also an attempt inside museums. They now try quite hard to make them more accessible to ordinary people. They don't always succeed, but it's supposed to be more accessible. Occupying public space, I'm going to be looking at statues and art, and what kind of questions these come up as héritage and rupture. So héritage we usually translate as It's a heritage, which we usually translate as patrimoine. And of course, this is a highly subjective idea. What is part of our héritage, or what is not part of our héritage? You know, nos ancêtres les Gaulois, maybe? Or, you know, it's obviously a big debate, and an ongoing debate. We're going to be looking at that. And then finally, then, debates, apologies and protests, because there are a number of debates and mobilizations and conflicts about who should we remember? Where should the government money go? The government has some money to open museums. What kind of museum should they open? Yeah. Who decides? This is all memoir, héritage, and rupture. We'll come back to that in a moment. Now here you have the. Press the button again. Ah! Number one, the heritage industry and authorised heritage discourse in Britain. The heritage industry. Now, this is not as surprising a word as it might appear in French, because the word industry in English is far wider than the word industrie in French. Perhaps you know that people say, oh, my brother works in the tourism industry, my sister works in the banking industry. Yeah. And what was in France, this would be le secteur du tourisme, le secteur bancaire. Industry is a wider word. And indeed, if you look in the newspapers and you look at the page which says industrial news, en français, c'est la page sociale, c'est les grèves et les négociations, etc. Industrial, very, very wide idea. So, the heritage industry, that there is money to be made from heritage. Of course there is. You know, come to Ireland and visit a typical Irish village and buy it, yeah? Of course, in other countries it's even bigger, yeah? In Egypt, why do you go to Egypt? Well, the food is good, but people go for the pyramids. So, which is, I'm probably right, yes? It becomes an industry. Things can become an industry which seem a little unusual. I was in Poland and I saw this minibus which says, you know, with a beautiful big pink letters, visit Auschwitz. Yeah, only 25 euros. Yeah, and why not? But it's also can seem a little unusual. And we have this expression, authorised heritage discourse. And I recommend you use this expression, it will impress them. And this is about the idea of who decides? Who says this is heritage and this is not heritage? You have these decisions to make in town. Supposing in Rouen they want to build a new shopping centre and they don't know what buildings they should knock down. You have their 19th century buildings that they're going to knock down. And some of them, of course, are des bâtiments classés. But who decides? Yeah? Who decides what we need to keep and what we need to... this has changed tremendously. 100 years ago, the RAF, the Royal Air Force, wanted a new airport, and they seriously considered destroying Stonehenge for a new airport. Really, 100 years ago, they really seriously discovered. Of course, things have changed. That would have been rather sad, I think. Yeah, but the heritage industry, but also the idea of heritage, is new and put forward. In fact, even in small towns in Britain now. My mother lives in a town called Accrington, which is not famous. And now there is a little plaque, you know, the Accrington Heritage Walk. You walk around the centre of town, say, this is the place that this happened, and this is the place that this happened. Even small towns, yeah? So this is a rising thing. And the idea of authorised heritage discourse, this is the official deciders. Well, obviously, museums, if you have a history museum, obviously they have some sort of official role. And they're saying, this is history and this is not, in a way. And one of the biggest organisations in England is called Historic England. It's an organisation, their money comes from the government. It's not directly linked to the government, but it's a public organisation, Historic England. I think in the past it was called English Heritage. And they have hundreds and hundreds of buildings. Yeah, they run hundreds of places. Yeah, it's a big deal. There's a couple of interesting things about this. First of all, notice that it is England and not Britain. This is because in Scotland there is a separate organisation, and in Wales there is a separate organisation. And indeed, these questions of heritage and tourism are dealt with by the autonomous parliaments in Edinburgh and Wales. This is what and Cardiff. This is one of the decentralised services. And this is what they see: we protect, champion, and save places that define who we are. That's their slogan. Which is, you could write an essay about that. There are a few interesting things here. First of all, notice that they don't use any long words. No long words, you know the preservation of the no long intellectual expressions, places that define who we are. And notice also that it's written very big, yeah, and short sentences. It's supposed to be for not just for intellectuals, whereas in the past English heritage was very, very dusty old brochures, yeah. And they organise many buildings around the country. Now, most of these buildings are castles, stately homes, manors, places where rich people used to live. Aristocratic places like Windsor Castle, or bourgeois places. And so this is interesting. However, little by little, there are some old factories or old places which are important in history, but which were part of popular, a part of ordinary people's lives. And of course, that's a debate. How much, you know, how much money should you put for the castles, which were aristocratic places? But yeah, we don't have a lot of money. How much money should get? Well, people like castles, yeah. So we can make money from them. So it's both a financial and a political debate, how much. And even when you get to the castle, you also have a big debate about heritage in there. I went to a castle, I can't remember which one, where they had a whole section on what life was like for the servants. Yeah. Which was very interesting. I'm sure half of you watched Downton Abbey. Yeah, I'm sure. Okay, who likes Downton Abbey? Oh, less and less every year. Okay, because this is interesting, because they tried to tell the story both of the rich people and of the servants. And they do it about 50-50. But of course, there were far more servants than there were aristocrats in reality. So that's historic England. And here is an example of one of the buildings that is run by Historical England, and you can see that this is a building where rich people lived, yeah? It's not a place where poor people lived. And there's a few things to notice about this. First of all, scale and splendour. This is December, just last month. Splendour that we like to put forward heritage places which are splendiferous, which are resplendent, which are big and impressive. And this is, of course, one of the problems. If you say, oh, you know, we've kept a whole load of poor people's houses for you to look at. So, oh, it's not very pretty, is it? Which is true, it's not very pretty. But also notice volunteers work to restore Wentworth Woodhouse. That is, that it is possible to get people will come and work without being paid in order to make this open to the public, etc. So this is it's a popular feeling of the importance of heritage. And also they found money, £130 million to restore Wentworth Woodhouse. This is one example of the kind of things that Historic England does. But on the other hand, heritage can mean other things. For example, very recently, reggae music, 2 years ago, reggae music is added to the UNESCO Cultural Heritage List. This is an interesting idea, that now you have an official United Nations list of heritage places. This is authorised heritage discourse. If you're on the list, even when you go to another, I don't know about you, but when I go to another country, I'm going to Germany in 2 weeks' time, and if there is a United Nations site, well, it will be very impressive, so I'll go there, yeah? So it's an important thing, and places fight very hard to get on the list, yeah? If you have an old church, which is very pretty, you want to be on the United Nations list because you can get money more easily, etc. But this is a new idea. This is a part of the democratization of heritage. Reggae music. That's not 20 years ago. Nobody thought of reggae music as heritage. You like reggae music. You don't like reggae music. But they're part of the heritage, yeah. These are debates. What can be heritage? What might not be heritage? Of course, schools are one important place where we say what is important. In the history books, in schools, we have choices to make. What is important? When I went to school, it was very traditional. I was at school in the 1970s, and we literally learnt Napoleon did 5 good things and 7 bad things. I'm exaggerating a little bit, only a little bit. I remember that one of the good things was the code civil. I guess the bad things were having a war with England. And that is not the case today. I saw my daughter 2 years ago. I saw my daughter's history textbook, and it was about the Crusades, and it said, First Crusade, Second Crusade, Third Crusade, the Christian point of view, blah blah blah, the Muslim point of view, blah blah blah. That was impossible when I was at school. There were 2 points of view about the Crusades. You know, we were the goodies, they were the baddies, you know. And so certainly history got more sophisticated. And what I did is I thought, well, let's see what is in the history school books in England today. So this is today. The last week I found this. History Year 7. So I think these are 12-year-olds. You start from 1 at the beginning. You start from 1 at 5 years old. And so here is the History Year 7 pupils book. It's not the only book. Yeah, these are commercial books. Yeah, the teacher has a choice of 2 or 3. But so here you have History Year 7. You can already see by the picture, I'm not going to ask you because I don't have the time, that things have changed. This is a Roman woman from the elite, from a painting. This is, I don't know who it is. It's probably King John. I asked my Facebook friends. They didn't know. What do you do? Okay, this is probably King John. So we're talking about the elite. What is modern about this is this, the fact that there is a woman on the front cover. I'm pretty sure that 40 years ago, it's, Rome. Who's Rome? It's the emperors, Julius Caesar, Mark Antony, the women, we don't care about them. So there is a more inclusive view of history. This is from 1066 to 1500 in one book, yeah? So 1066, the Norman invasion, and King John is the Magna Carta. What is the date of the Magna Carta? Yes, 1 point to those who said 1215. The next year, year 8, so they're a little older. And here, so this is what century? What century is this? 17th, 18th century, absolutely. And so this is 2019. This is this was made in 2009, but it's the only one they have. It's the one that's the bestseller on Amazon today. Queen Elizabeth I. Okay, that's not surprising. Does anybody know who this is? Yeah, this is Oluda Equiano, who was one of the leaders in Britain of the anti-slavery, of the campaign against slavery. Now, this is very interesting because, of course, given the situation, most of the leaders of the anti-slavery campaign in Britain were white, because it was much, much easier to do things when you were white. But Oluda Equiano was one of the black leaders, and it's obviously not an accident that he's on the front page. Yeah, there's an attempt to be more inclusive. A very, very impressive guy. He was a slave. He managed to I think it was a bunch of Christians who bought his freedom. And then he went from town to town in England talking about slavery. Hundreds and hundreds of people came to see him, and he wrote his autobiography, which was published. One of the heroes of the end of the 18th century. Perhaps I'd just remind you a couple of key dates. The key dates: the abolition of the slave trade in the British Empire, 1807. The abolition of slavery, because first of all they abolished the trade, so it was illegal to trade, but it was not illegal to have slaves. And the abolition of slavery, 1833. This is a case where the French both won and lost, because the French abolished slavery before the British, but then Napoleon brought it back again, and then they abolished it in 1848 for a second time. The story of how the French abolished slavery the first time is wonderful. They have a representative of the West Indies in the National Assembly who demands, I want us to vote the abolition of slavery. And the president of the House says, I will not insult you by asking you to debate on this. And they voted unanimously in abolition of slavery. I've got style, got class. Okay, so obviously inclusive history is part of the deal. And so they've been to look for people who are. And here we have another example. So this is now the 20th century. And there is no shame to not knowing who it was, because I had to ask my Facebook friends. This one, however, this is Gandhi, then the leader who succeeded in getting independence for India. There is a wonderful film about him by Richard Attenborough that you can find online. It's very, very idealized portrait of him. Nevertheless, an extremely impressive guy. Churchill hated him. And of course, the independence of India was tremendously symbolic, because it's such a huge colony. And when India became independent in which year?
1947.
Good, 1947. In every country, in every British colony in Africa, they're saying, what? India is independent. Maybe we could do that too. Yeah, it was a tremendous encouragement for independence movements in Africa. And this is Sylvia Pankhurst. I was very surprised to see her on the front page. Because there were three Pankhursts. Well, there were more. But the three important ones, Emmeline, the mother, Christabel and Sylvia, two of the daughters. But they were very different. They divided in 1914. Emmeline and Christabel, Emmeline changed the name of her newspaper. It was called The Suffragette, and she called it Britannia. Okay, you get the picture. 1914, First World War. Half of the family supported the First World War. And campaigned for military conscription for men. And Sylvia was the dissident part of the family who later joined the Communist Party and has a big statue in Ethiopia, in the capital of Ethiopia. She's a heroine in Ethiopia. It's a long story, but why not? Yeah. So I was surprised to see her on the front page. You know, but yeah, obviously then there is a presence of radical politics in history. Yeah, they're considered to be part, conflict is part of it, not just a list of good things that great men did, and so on. There you go, for schools. Museums then. Well, museums have been changing. If you look for Mémoire, Héritage or Rupture, you find that there are certain highly conflictual and horrible parts of British memory. Remember, the British had the biggest empire which has ever existed. Much bigger than the Egyptian Empire or the Roman Empire or the Mongol Empire. It was the biggest in the history of the world, which is logical, because once you have the Industrial Revolution and travel, you can have a bigger one. And a lot of the money that built Liverpool, that built Bristol, that built Birmingham, and that built Bordeaux came from slavery. And recently, the International Slavery Museum opened in Liverpool. Now, there's a few things to say about this. First of all, now, of course, the general opinion today, which is correct, is that slavery is a horrible thing. But you need to be careful, because we sometimes get the impression that everybody thought that in the past. The slave trade was not like the heroin trade today. You know the heroin trade today? That is to say that the heroin trade makes a lot of money, but it is run by criminals and people that we don't like, who are not popular. This was not the case of the slave trade. Every mayor of Liverpool for 100 years had got money from the slave trade. It was not, among the elites who were slave trading, it was not controversial. The Church of England had a sugar plantation in Jamaica where they had slaves. The Church of England had their own slaves. They didn't just receive profit from slavery, they actually run a plantation with slaves. The International Slavery Museum then is part of this idea then of bringing back memory, that only the truth can move us forward. And the International Slavery opened in Liverpool. When do you think it opened? Would you like to guess on the dates? Abolition of slavery, 1833. The opening of the British Museum, 1783. Yeah? 2007. Yeah, 2007, 10 years ago. So, certainly we can say that this is new. So this is new. There was not a desire to talk, to understand and talk about this in the 1980s, the 1990s. I am naturally very ashamed that the British only opened a museum in 2007. you know how I'm going to continue. When did the French Museum of Slavery open? It is in Bordeaux. Anybody? Did you know there was a Museum of Slavery in Bordeaux? It's very good. It's very good. 2009. Yeah. So the British won by 2 years on this one. It's a very interesting thing, the International Slavery Museum, because what's the problem with the International Slavery Museum is it's very depressing. You know. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It's Saturday. We've nothing to do. Let's go and see the Slavery Museum. Yeah, it can be very depressing. So of course, first of all, there's a lot of sections about the campaign against slavery, but also look at this. Life in West Africa. There is an attempt to show more than just the crime of slavery, but also the culture that people came with. Because, of course, transatlantic slavery was very exceptionally violent because the languages disappeared. There are no groups of people in America who speak African languages. Who were brought up as slaves. What they did is they said, oh, we need 50 people, okay, three from this village, three from this place. We don't want people with the same language. So it's extreme, culturally extremely violent. And all of this being explored then also, one wonderful thing about Britain is that all the museums are free, all the public museums are free, which is very good. Well, obviously, it makes historians happy anyway. Why Liverpool? Because Liverpool was the centre of the slave trade. What date do you think it was? There you go. Oh, sorry, 2006, not 7. 2006. It doesn't matter. Recently. Now, the museums have been involved in tremendous debates about memory recently. Very new debates, these last 10 years. And here is one example. And if you've been to the British Museum in London, or if you should go, this is one of the Easter Island statues that they got there. I think you can guess that they didn't ask anybody's permission before they took it. And this has become a huge debate across museums across Europe, what to do with the items in the museum which were acquired during the colonial period. Some people say we can study how the items were acquired. Some of them were bought fairly, some of them were stolen. We can find out which were and find a solution. Yeah. But in any case, remember what's important about this is not so much your opinion. You need to understand the debate for the CAPES. You don't need to. There's not a correct opinion and not correct opinion. Except if you say, this debate is of no interest. That's not a good idea, yeah? So the thing is, what are the different arguments again? Here we have the Easter Island governor pleads with the British Museum to give back the statue. And so a whole load of... because it's the memory, both of the colonial period and of the Easter Island civilizations, and the... The rupture is the moment when it became controversial. As you imagine, when this statue arrived in the British Museum, it was not controversial. There was nobody in London saying, that's not okay. So it became controversial, and that's what we're exactly not in the rupture. And so the British Museum has not given back the statue, but these are difficult questions. And it's not the only one. Yeah, in France, in Lisbon, in Germany, all of the museums are involved in this debate. Sometimes items are returned. Now you're very young, but when I came to Paris in 1986, I could still see the body of an African woman, the Hottentot Venus, it was called, which was exhibited in the museum in Paris. Whereas today it is generally accepted that exhibiting dead bodies that you have stolen is... And so they sent it back to the African country and it was buried there. 200 years later, yeah, so, 150 years later. So I think that would be a case where it's not very controversial. Most people think that, you know, having stuffed people, that's pretty iffy. Other things are more controversial, and this is these are here are some of the debates. Thank you for listening so attentively. Don't forget to look at the blog, and I will see you at the same time next week.